Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It's May the 6th. May 6th. We're in Parshas Bahar on page 696. We're starting again from Pasuk Ches. Verse 8. Last time we spoke about Shemitah, and now in this paragraph, we read it a little bit last week, we're going to read it again, and we move into Yovel. Yovel has the same laws as Shemitah, but there are several things that are different that are added in Yovel over Shemitah. And we may as well mention that this only happens once a year, but we happen to be now learning the Parsha of the week. You shall count for yourself seven years of seven. Sheva shanim sheva peyamim, 7 years, seven times. And it'll be for you the seven years, 49 years. So you're going to count 49 years, having a Shemitah at the end of every 7 years. Then Vahavarta Shofar Turua Bakodesha Shvi'i, you will blow the shofar in the 7th month. Be'asol HaChodesh, on the 10th of the month on Yom Kippur. We spoke about last time how this year of Yovel, then we blow shofar on Yom Kippur, just as we do on Rosh Hashanah. B'yom HaKippurim Taviru Shofar B'chol Artzachem, on Yom Kippur, you'll blow shofar in your entire land. That would mean that everywhere the shofar is blown, not just in Beis Din, not just in the Beis HaMikdash, but everywhere the shofar is blown on Yovel, on Yom Kippur. In addition to Rosh Hashanah, it is blown on Yom Kippur. V'kidashtem eis shna sachamishim shana, you shall sanctify the 50th year. Ukrasem duror baretz l'chol yoshvel, you shall call freedom in the land for all of its dwellers. Yovel hi tiyel lachem, it shall be a Yovel. Yovel means a ram. That's what a Yovel means. So the shofar, which comes from a ram, is why the year is called Yovel. Vishavtem ish elachuzaso, each man shall return to his inheritance, his portion. Vishal mishpachto tashuvu, each man shall return to his family. We will discuss presently what does it mean to go free, what does it mean each man returns to his inheritance. We'll talk about those two things in a moment. Yovel hi shnasa chamishim shana, the 50th year is Yovel. I'm sorry. Yovel hi it is Yovel shnasa chamishim shana tiyel lachem, the 50th year shall be for you. Lo sizra'u, you shall not plant. Velo siktzru es sifichel, you shall not harvest that which grows wild, meaning harvest a lot, keeping more than you need. Velo sivtzru es nizireha, and you shall not harvest its grapes, its vineyards. Ki Yovel hi, for it is Yovel kodesh tielachem, it shall be sanctified for you. Mina asadet tochlu es tvuasa, you shall eat its crop, its produce from the field. Bishnas hayovel hazos, in this year of Yovel, toshuvu ish elachuzasu, each man shall return to his inheritance, which sounds redundant, we had mentioned that already. But let's explain, what does it mean to go free? What does it mean to go back to the land? So the freedom is referring to Jewish slaves. An Eved Ivri, a man who was sold into slavery or sold himself into slavery, as we learned before in Parashas Mishpatim, it's a 6-year tenure as slave. If Yovel happens during those 6 years, then the slave goes free. Cannot stay past Yovel. Even if he's a nirtza, even if he had his ear pierced, which would make him be a slave for up to 50 years, when Yovel comes, he goes free. It is not a choice. When there's Yovel, when Yovel happens, all the slaves go free, whether they want to stay slave or not. They all go free. One cannot stay a slave past the Yovel year. The Yovel year sets all slaves free. All Jewish slaves go free. It's not referring to the non-Jewish slaves. It was referring to only the Jewish slaves. They go free in the Yovel year, irrespective of what they're up to. Whether they're still within the first 6 years, I'd say it's the third year of their six-year stint, they go free, or whether they had their ear pierced and they're in the 22nd year, they go free. That's what it means, that they return to their families, they go free.
Was ever a situation in the Gemara which states someone who was poor and didn't want to really be free, that they...
I don't remember a case like that in the Gemara, but they didn't have Yovel in the Gemara anymore.
Okay.
The Yovel is we'll talk about in a moment.
We'll discuss.
Yeah.
What about after the Yovel year? What if they want to be a slave again?
They would have to resell themselves into slavery.
But it's possible to do it afterwards.
In theory, it is, but it would be a new contract. It wouldn't be. Now, what does it mean to go back to the land? So, we know that land in Israel is owned based on the Jews who came out of Egypt. The Jews who came out of Egypt, then based on the Jews who went into Eretz Israel. Mr. Shem will learn about that. We have not yet discussed how it worked, the land being divided up according to those who left Egypt. But those left Egypt died in the wilderness, in the Midbar, and then a different generation entered Eretz Yisrael. So there's a system for how it was divided up. But however it was divided up, once land was in a family, it then got handed down from generation to generation. Land that is sold in Eretz Yisrael is unlike any type of real estate sales that you have in other parts of the world. When land is sold in Eretz Yisrael, when Eretz Yisrael is being treated appropriately, the way the Torah says to, then it is only a sale up until Yovel. And at Yovel, the land goes back to the original owner. The sale can only be until then. So, for example, if in the 32nd year of a Yovel cycle, you choose to sell your land, it can only remain in the buyer's possession for up to 18 years. But once you hit Yovel, the land automatically goes back to the seller. It goes back to the original owner. He gets his land back. And that's what it means, that the land, the people go back to their land. It goes back to the original owner. Real estate in Eretz Yisrael, when Eretz Yisrael is being treated the way the Torah says to treat it, is unlike other real estate normally, what we're used to is that real estate can be an investment where you buy land and then you hope it appreciates over time and perhaps you sell it later and make a profit. In Israel, when the Torah is being kept properly, real estate always depreciates. Always. Because when you land in the first year of Yovel, it's worth a lot more than land is worth in the 30th year of Yovel. Because if you buy land in the first year of Yovel, you can hold on to it for 49 years. If you buy land in the 30th year of Yovel, you only have 19 years left to hold it. So it's land depreciates over time. It does not appreciate, it always depreciates. If you buy land, let's say, in the 8th year of Yovel, so you bought land in the 8th year of Yovel, that gives you the land for 42 years. Let's say you bought it for $420,000. That means each year was worth $10,000. If you sell the land 6 years later, it's no longer worth $420,000. It's only worth $360,000 because you only have 36 years left till Yovel. So the land depreciates. Once you get to Yovel, it goes back to the original owner. Then after Yovel, the price of land shoots back up. Because now, if the land is sold, the buyer can hold on to it for 49 years. And then from then on, it depreciates over time until the Yovel year. So it's completely different than the way real estate works anywhere else. If you think about it, that also discourages development of the land. Because normally, why is land developed? Land is developed because the developer is looking to make a profit on selling the land. The person buys the land, develops it, and then sells it. Well, that doesn't work with land that's going to go back to the original owner at Yovel. It's going to go back for free at Yovel. You can't charge him to get his land back, even if you made the land better. But let's say you buy the land from the owner, you buy it in the 40th year of Yovel, which means you get to hold on to it for 10 years. During that time, you build apartments, you improve irrigation, you do whatever you do to the land to make it a better land. Well, after 10 years, it goes back to the original owner for free. No matter what you did, you lose it. So this actually discourages development of the land by anybody other than the family. The family has everything to gain to develop the land, because the land always stays in the family. Even if the land has to be sold, it will eventually come back to the family. So the family has a vested interest in developing the land, but buyers do not have any vested interest in developing the land. They would only say, my person would buy land is to get whatever they can out of it in the near future, in the immediate future, not for long term. So it's a completely different mindset for how real estate works in Eretz Yisrael when the Torah is kept properly. Question.
So they weren't developing apartment buildings.
No.
It was all agriculture.
That's right.
So could you then take your produce with you back to your place?
Yeah, well, once you harvest it, it's your produce. But think about it, when you have land that you're going to use, however you're going to use it, let's say you're going to use it agriculturally, mm-hmm. there are improvements that can be made. The irrigation system can be made better, the weeding system, whatever it is.
So was it to discourage people from...
I can't... The Torah, this is a system Torah. I'm only telling you the result.
Okay, and where do the Levites go?
Well, we haven't gotten to them yet. We'll get to that. Bad cities, that, we'll get to that.
Well, it's personal with
them. It's personal. Okay, we'll get to that. We'll get to them. Yeah. Then. Right now we're dealing with everybody but the Levian.
Okay.
Right, and the Kohen. Yeah.
Within the family, who inherits the land?
So we haven't gotten to the rules of inheritance yet. That's going to be in Parshas Pinchas, but there are rules for that as well. How the land...
If it's more than one brother or son in a family, eventually you're going to get a postage stamp.
Well, it won't be a postage stamp because the land is very, very large. But yeah, it'll get smaller and smaller as time goes on, assuming that the population increases. Unfortunately, our history has had the population increase and then decrease and then increase and then decrease. We have not sustained increased growth over a very, very long period of time, unfortunately. But you're right. If the Jews would keep the Torah properly, mm-hmm. and we would increase, as Moshe says, we just keep on increasing, thousands and thousands of times are the size that we were when we went into Eretz Yisrael, then yes, eventually the land should be nearly minuscule per person, unless the land itself increases, which that may actually happen. But at least as far as natural law goes, over time everybody's piece should get smaller and smaller, which also encourages family members to work together. Now, this system not only encourages family development of the land, it also encourages family cohesiveness. Because if I have a tiny portion, my brother's a tiny portion, we can't do much with it. But if we work together, we can. So that it encourages that as well. But again, I'm not saying here why the Torah says it. I'm only telling you the result. Because you have to put your mind into, as we're going to go on over here, we're going to see many rules governing the land. And it's completely different than anything that we're used to when you think about real estate in the United States. Everything is different. The very fact that you can't charge interest on a loan makes the entire economic system completely different than what we're used to. So the whole thing is a different mindset. So one has to actually think these things through and put themselves in the shoes of those living in Israel when these laws are being kept, and realize that everything we take for a given today is not a given, and to think it through again. So that's what it means that the land goes back to its original owner. Now, there is a machlokes whether the Yovel year doubles as the first year of the next 50-year cycle or not, which means as follows. We know you count seven Shemitahs. That's 49 years. Seven times seven, you have 49 years. The following year, year number 50, is Yovel. Is Yovel a standalone year? In which case, year 50 is Yovel, year 51 is now the first year of the next Shemitah cycle. So that means the next Yovel, Yovel number 2, will be in year 100. Every 50 years you have Yovel, and then you have 49 years of 9 Yovel, and then the 50th year is Yovel. That's one way to look at it. That is one opinion. There is another opinion that says that Yovel doubles as the first year of the next Shemitah cycle. So that means you have count 49 years, year 50 is Yovel, but year 50 is also year number 1 of the next cycle. And then you continue to count and then 6 years after Yovel will be Shemitah. Not 7 years after Yovel, but only 6 years after Yovel will be Shemitah. So that the next Yovel will not be in year 100, it'll be in year 99. Because the Yovel year doubles as year one of the next 50 years. So that is a debate in the Mishnayos. Generally speaking, the commentaries assume the way I think most people in this room assumed, which is that Yovel is a standalone year. It's a 50th year, it's not year one of the next cycle, and therefore the next Yovel will be year 100, and the next Yovel will be year 150. That is certainly the simpler way to think about it. And we will use that model as we go through the discussion of Yovel. But you should be aware that it is not cut and dry. There is a discussion about that in the Mishnayos and continuing into the Gemara. The reason why we don't know anything about Yovel today is because we don't have Yovel today. Mm-hmm. We do have Shemitah. Shemitah is kept in Eretz Yisrael, as we spoke about last week. Shemitah is... 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So Shemitah is observed, but Yovel is not observed. Because Shemitah is not dependent on anything other than being in Israel. If you're in Israel, then you have to keep Shemitah. Just as if you're in Israel and you grow crops, then you have to keep the laws of Trumos and Maestros. You have to give to the Kohen and the Levi, even though today a Kohen can't eat the Truma because it becomes Tameh. But still, the laws of tithing have to be observed because the crops were going in Eretz Yisrael. Now you can debate what are the biblical boundaries of Eretz Yisrael and what is actually subject to these laws. That you can debate, and it is debated. However, if you are in an area that is most certainly Eretz Yisrael, you have to keep the laws of Trumos and Maestros, irrespective of how many Jews are living in Israel, whether we have autonomy, whether we have authority. If you have land, you grow crops in Israel, then you have to tithe.
With Shemitah, how do they decide when to start,
I'll explain that. Okay, good question. So too, if you're in Israel during the Shemitah year, then you got to keep Shemitah. That's the way it works. Yovel does not work that way. Yovel is not observed today. Now, it is not, again, not cut and dry. I can't tell you 100% that this is the opinion of everybody, but what is most often quoted about Yovel is that Yovel only is observed when most Jews are living in Israel. In addition to that, it seems that there would have to be representation from all the tribes in Israel. That's another added point that some of the commentaries make. Be that as it may, Yovel is not observed because we don't have enough people living in Israel. We don't have enough of the majority. We don't have all the tribes living in Israel. And remember, you have to define what is Israel. Living in Israel does not mean living in the state of Israel. It means living on the land that is biblically designated as the land of Israel. Now, the biblical designation of the land of Israel is not a simple question either. If you use the boundaries stated in the Torah itself, which we'll get to Mirz Hashem later, not tonight, we'll get to hopefully within the year, but if you deal with the boundaries mentioned in the Torah itself, so the boundaries of Israel would go, of biblical Israel, will extend south, not as far as the state of Israel. The state of Israel, without question, today, extends further south than what is biblically the state of Israel. Biblically Israel. There is no question about that. Eilat is not part of biblical Israel, without question. There's no debate about that. The state of Israel goes at least to Be'er Sheva, perhaps a little further south than that, not that much further south. However, to the north, the biblical boundaries of Israel go much further. It includes most, I think maybe all of Lebanon, much of Syria, and extends up in that direction. Also, of course, it includes much of Jordan. Right. So the boundaries of the biblical Israel are larger than the current state of Israel, but nevertheless, there are parts of the state of Israel that are not included. It's not the same exact boundaries. But that's the biblical boundaries of Israel. That those boundaries were sanctified when the Jews came to Israel with Yehoshua after Moshe passed away. And they came into Israel, they conquered Israel, and they sanctified those boundaries. However, after the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed and the Jews were taken in exile to Babylonia, when we returned to Israel, they had to sanctify the land all over again. And this time, the Yishuv, where the Jews lived, was much smaller than the original state of Israel, the original boundaries of Israel. It was in and around Yerushalayim. And therefore, what is called today the West Bank is, I don't know if it's all of the West Bank, but much of the West Bank is what was made kadosh, made sanctified when we came back for the second temple. The rest of the land was not sanctified because we didn't live there. That was occupied territory. It was occupied by non-Jews living in our land. So therefore, it was never sanctified. The rule is that what was sanctified the first time when Yehoshua came lost its sanctity when we were taken into exile to Babylonia. What was sanctified the second time remains kadosh, remains sanctified today. Well, it's a much smaller area than biblical Israel. And therefore, it becomes debatable if a person is living, let's say, in Tel Aviv, are they living in Israel? They are living certainly within the boundaries of the biblical Israel, but are they living within sanctified Israel? That's not so simple that that would be called living in sanctified Israel, because it is not the area that was made sanctified after we came back from Babylonia. Therefore, it opens up an entire discussion over whether Trumas and Maisos need to be tithed from the area around Tel Aviv, whether Shemitah needs to be kept around there, and when you discuss Jews living in Israel, do you count those living in Tel Aviv towards this number? All of this is debated. Nothing is simple about this. Perhaps we do include it, perhaps we don't include it. It's an entire discussion. Whatever it is, the bottom line is today we do not observe Yovel. Not because we don't want to, but because we're not obligated to keep Yovel today. We are obligated to keep Shemitah.
We've learned it, I don't remember. How was the land sanctified? What does that mean, to sanctify the land?
Yeah, so they did go, they went through a process of sanctifying the land. The Gemara discusses it, what they did with under Ezra, when they came back.
Ezra,
and Nehemiah.
I can't remember.
Yeah, yeah, it is discussed how it's done. I don't know if we discussed it or not.
We studied Ezra.
I don't remember if we talked about it or not.
No, we discussed about he helped find the families who were the Kohen or the different, We don't let that information out.
It is biblically ours. It is biblically ours. The question is it sanctified?
Name, but you don't want the press or CNN to know it.
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
Clarification. So sanctification, is that what you're saying? We referred to Shemitah and tithing and
how we handle the land? It's debated. That's what I'm saying. It's a debate. There's no question the area in and around Yerushalayim is you're required to tithe, you're required to keep Shemitah. The areas that are further away, it's not so simple. Certainly it's required rabbinically, because it's so close to Eretz Yisrael. But whether it is required from the Torah is not so simple. It is debated.
But we didn't do everything. We didn't get rid of, like, the Canaanites or the Philistines. In certain lands when we were supposed to get rid of,
yes,
and we didn't.
Yes.
So is that land still?
Yeah, it was still sanctified. The first time it was sanctified. Yeah.
Even though we didn't do the right thing.
Yeah, it's true. But they still sanctified it the first time around. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When did Yovel stop?
I don't know. I assume Yovel stopped. Did they have it in the second Beis HaMikdash? I assume it was kept during the second Beis HaMikdash. I don't know for sure. I mean, there were so few people living there in the second Beis HaMikdash. Yeah, I don't know.
When the northern tribes got separated,
yeah,
then they no longer...
Right. I don't know. I know, it's a good question.
Yeah, especially if you needed someone from each tribe.
Yeah.
Anymore.
Yeah, I don't know. As I said, these are debated points. These are not points that not everybody says each thing. These are different factors that are involved. Now, Dina asked, how do we calculate the Shemitah year? It happens to be that it works out mathematically based on the years since the world was created. So we say that this is the year 5778. So if you divide 5778 by 7, it will not divide evenly. When it does divide evenly, then that is a Shemitah year. Now, it doesn't have to work that way, but that is, it does work out that way, which makes it simpler. So that's okay. How you know
whether so that's it's a Shemitah.
How they did it. Okay. Yeah, that's how the Shemitah works, at least now. So as I said, we don't keep the Yovel year, but we do keep the Shemitah year. Now, so far, when mentioning the Yovel, we have said that it has the same laws as Shemitah, at least agriculturally, it has the same laws as Shemitah. And now we've added, in addition, we've added the rule of slaves going free, and we've added the rule of the land returning to its owner. Mm-hmm. We've also talked about how there is shofar blown on Yom Kippur, the same way it's blown on Rosh Hashanah. We talked about last time how it's the longest davening of 50 years, is the Musaf of Yom Kippur on a Yovel year. There are other laws which we will see as we move on through this parsha, through Bahar. We will see other applications of Yovel that will affect the land. Now, I mentioned peripherally last time, I'm going to mention it again, also peripherally, I want to remind everybody that Shemitah has another element to it besides agricultural, and that is the law affecting loans.
Forgiving debts.
Forgiving debts, right. That debts are forgiven in the Shemitah year. That is something else that occurs, and that does apply today as well. In theory, that would apply to the Yovel year, except that the Yovel year coming on the heels of a Shemitah year, there are no debts to forgive. So that doesn't affect anything, but the Shemitah year does cause the debts to be forgiven. We will get to that, but it is not. It'll be a little while till we get to that particular law. When we get there, please God, we'll talk about it. But just be aware that that applies as well. It's not just agricultural; it also affects the monetary system in that way. Pasuk Yudal, verse 14. V'chisim kirumim karla misacha. When you will sell an item to your friend, to your fellow Jew, o kanomi ana misecha, or when you purchase from your fellow Jew, al tonu ish es achiv, do not molest one man his brother, which means don't over or undercharge. What does it say over there?
Do not aggrieve.
Okay. Do not aggrieve. This is onas mamon. This is the prohibition against overcharging if you are the seller and underpaying if you are the buyer. Before I explain that, let me just mention to you that it is from this pasuk also that we derive that if you are going to buy or sell, then you should at first seek a fellow Jew with whom to do business, as we know that it is important to patronize Jewish businesses. And this is where we derive it from, that it says that if you're going to sell, sell to your fellow Jew. If you're going to buy, buy from fellow Jew. Of course, it means if there is a fellow Jew who wants to buy or sell from you, then you should prioritize the Jew over the non-Jew. Then it says, al tonu isha sachiv, which is don't, as they say, aggrieve, don't overcharge if you are the seller, don't underpay if you're the buyer. This means if the other party is unaware of the going rate and you realize that you can get away with something, so one is not allowed to do that to a fellow Jew. So that means if the going rate is $100 and I am selling it to you and I realize that you believe that it actually costs $200, so I know I could charge you $200 and get away with it, that is prohibited. Similarly, if I am buying from you and the item is worth $100, I know it's worth $100, you believe it's worth $50, so I know I can get away with only paying $50, that is prohibited. There is an allowance for making a profit, and that is up to a sixth of the value of the item, not more than a sixth. That would be called onah. That would be called overcharging to pay more than a sixth, or underpaying. You can underpay within a sixth of its value, but more than that would be prohibited. Now, two people can agree on a price if they're both aware that it's a different price than the going rate. So that if the going rate is $100 and I'm selling it to you, and we agree, even we say to each other, we know the price is $100, but we are going to agree that you're going to pay $200, or we are going to agree that you're going to pay $50, that is acceptable, because neither of us is grieving the other. We've made an agreement, and that's fine. This prohibition is when no agreement was made, but rather it is being done without the knowledge of the buyer or seller, or even with the knowledge, but they're being forced into the transaction. That would be a prohibition. Yeah?
Does this also apply to Gentiles?
No.
Jews are not available, and you can't sell it to anybody, and it's only to... You know,
it's only to a fellow Jew. That's why it says, "Al tonu ish es achiv," only your brother, only to a fellow Jew does this apply.
Yeah. Does interest fall into this?
You can't charge interest.
Why not? Do we learn it from here or
no,
it's elsewhere?
No, elsewhere. Elsewhere. We'll learn it from someplace else. Now, although this is true even when buying or selling regular items, but now the Torah is going to apply this to land. Even though land is a little different, but we're going to apply it to the years of Yovel. B'mispar shanim achar ha-Yovel tikneh me'es ha-misecha. According to the number of years after Yovel, you shall purchase from your friend. B'mispar shnei svuosim karlach. According to the number of years, he is selling it to you. This we explained before, that if I'm selling you land in year 21 of the Yovel cycle, then I'm only selling it to you until Yovel. And that should be taken into account, and the price should be based on how many harvests you're going to get between now and Yovel. Well, if he rov hashanim tarbeh miknaso, according to the many years, if there's a lot of years, then the price should be increased. Well, if he ma'ot hashanim, according to the fewer years, tam it miknaso, then the price should be decreased. For he is selling to you a number of harvests. That's what he's selling to you. He's selling to you the amount of harvests between now and Yovel. Now, there's something else learned from the... I read Pasuk Tezayin just now, 16. But in 15, in Tezvav, there is something else derived from the end of the verse. It says, B'mispar shenei sivuosim karlach, in the amount of the years of harvests, he is selling to you, or produce he's selling to you. The word shinei is short for the word shanim, years. That's the simple translation. However, we also know the word shinei means two. Therefore, it is derived from here that when land is sold in Israel between the two people, the land has to be sold for a minimum of 2 years. You can't sell land for less than 2 years, which means, as we're going to see presently, that when if I sell my inheritance land to you, then let's say it's year 21 of Yovel. So you're purchasing it for the next, whatever it is, 28 years through year 49. So if I want to buy it back from you 8 years later, you can't stop me from buying it back from you. We prorate the amount that you paid per year. So if you paid $280,000 for 28 years, that's $10,000 per year. 8 years later, if I come up with $200,000 and I want to buy it back from you, you have to sell it back to me. However, that is only after a minimum of 2 years. If I want to buy the land back after only a year, you can tell me no. You can stop me. Because the sale is for a minimum of 2 years. Obviously, it's different when we're dealing with a year before the Yovel. But if you have 2 years before the Yovel, the sale has to be for a minimum of 2 years. That's derived from the word shinei, 2 years. Pasuk Yizayin, verse 17. V'lo sonu ish es amiso, a man shall not aggrieve his friend. Now, we just had that before. But before it was talking about ona'as mamon, it was aggrieving financially. This is ona'as devarim. Mm-hmm. This is aggrieving with words. This is where you have the prohibition against saying something that is hurtful to somebody else. We know that there's lashon hara, which is saying something that is disparaging about someone to a third party. This is saying something disparaging to the person directly. That is onas devarim. That is saying, that is aggrieving one's friend with words. And that the prohibition is from here. One is not allowed. It is a prohibition in the Torah to go over to someone and say that, say to them, you know, you are a whatever, and call them a name. That would be prohibited from this pasuk. V'yarei samei elokecha, you shall fear your God. Ki ani Hashem elokechem, for I am Hashem, your God. Now, whenever it says v'yarei samei elokecha, that always is a that always announces to us that we're dealing with something which may not be evident. We may be dealing with something which is not clear, and it is fear Hashem, because Hashem knows. The person you're talking to may not know, but Hashem knows. Now, if you go over to someone and call them a name, they also know. You don't need Hashem to know it. The person knows it themselves. So, v'yareisa me'elokecha, you fear your God, is referring to a type of onas devarim, a type of aggrieving with words, which is not necessarily known to the person that you're speaking to. So what would that be? That would be giving them bad advice on purpose. That would be to give them bad advice on purpose, to deliberately mislead them so that they will do something which is bad for them but good for you. So that would fall under onas devarim. So if I would give a person advice because I really want to get hold of their land, and therefore, but I don't want to tell them that, because then they'll know that I'm really in it for myself. So I pretend that I'm in it for them, and I give them, quote-unquote, very good advice, that, you know, you really should get rid of that land. It's not very profitable right now. You really should be selling it. And then somehow I'm able to get a hold of the land. That would be lo sonu ish asami. So that would be an example of onas devarim, of aggrieving someone with words. I didn't use money to hurt him. He sold the land of his own volition, but it was through my poor advice, which was deliberately given. That would be lo sonu ish asami. So that would be onas devarim, aggrieving with words. Pasuk Yuches, verse 18, Vasisem eschul kosai, you shall do my statutes, Vas mishpatai tishmeru, and also do my laws, Vasisem osam, and perform them, Vishavtem al haaretz lavetach, and you shall dwell on the land in security. The keeping of Shemitah is directly linked to dwelling on the land in security. When Shemitah is kept appropriately, then we are able to dwell on the land securely. God forbid when Shemitah is not kept appropriately, then that is cause to be forcibly removed from the land. We're going to see later, when we talk about Golus, which will be spoken about in Parashas Bechukosai, the next parasha, when we talk about Golus, about exile, the Torah is going to link exile to the not keeping of Shemitah properly. This is the flip side of that, which is that keeping the Shemitah properly allows us to keep the land. We were in Israel from the time that we entered Israel until we were forcibly removed from Israel. We were there for 850 years. That's the amount of time that we were in Israel after we got to the land. We were there for... We were there for 440 years, I believe I have that correct, before the Beis HaMikdash was built. Then the Beis HaMikdash was built, another 410 years till it was destroyed, so that's 850 years. During that time, during those 850 years, so how many Shemitahs and Yovels do you have in 850 years? Dina's already figured it out.
No.
So, in 50 years, you have 7 Shemitahs and 1 Yovel. That's eight Shemitahs and Yovels in 50 years. In 100 years, you have 16 Shemitahs and Yovels. So, 8 times 16 is 144. Is that correct, I believe? 144?
48.
8 times 16, 148. Thank you. Yes. 140. Is that right? Make sure we get that right. 100 and... 8 times 16? No.
There's a blackboard.
120. What?
There's a blackboard.
128.
Because 8 sixes is 48.
Yeah. 128. 128. Plus another 8 for the next 50 years. That's 136 Shemitahs and Yovels over that time. Now that's assuming that we started keeping Shemitah and Yovel immediately when we entered the land, which again is not necessarily true because it wasn't conquered yet. But there you have approximately that amount of Shemitahs and Yovels. Over that time, much of the time, Shemitah and Yovel were kept appropriately. However, as we will see, we'll count up the years later, that there were times when the Jews were not keeping the Torah properly, and they did not keep Shemitah and Yovel the way they should have. The 70 years of Golus Bavel, of the exile of Bavel, corresponded to the 70 Shemitahs and Yovels that were not kept properly. Now, there were more than 70 Shemitahs and Yovels when we were in Israel. Those were kept properly. But roughly half of the Shemitahs and Yovels were not kept properly when we were in Israel. About half were kept appropriately and about half were kept inappropriately. But the ones that were not kept properly, the Golus, the 70 years of Bavel, correspond to those 70 years. Now, the count of those 70 years is not so cut and dry. The truth is that when they make the cheshbon, when they count out, they really only come up with 69 years, and then they have to show how we figure out that 70th year as well, and perhaps we'll talk about that at a later date. But be that as it may, that's the flip side of what we're reading over here. Is that when Shemitah is kept properly, we stay in the land. Shemitah is not kept properly, then the land unfortunately spits us out. And that's what happened with the Golos, with the exile of Bavel, that we were forcibly removed from the land because of not keeping it properly.
Is that the only reason? Could we also deal by the Zara?
It could be, but this is what the Torah says.
Okay.
Now, what we have not discussed is if you're not going to plant the land and you're not going to harvest the land, you're not going to work the land, and it's an agricultural society, and you don't have refrigeration, you don't have the preservatives that we have today, you don't have necessarily a good relationship with the non-Jews living around Israel from whom you could theoretically buy produce, what exactly are you going to eat in the Shemitah and Yovel years? So that is the next section of the Torah, starting with Pasuk Yud Tes, verse 19. We'll read it tonight, we may have to go over it again next time, but let's at least read it. V'nasnach aretz pirya, the land will give its produce. Ba'achal tem la'sova, you shall eat for satiation, which means that not only will you have food to eat, but the food will actually fill you up and nourish you on a lot less than you think. It will take very little food to both nourish and sustain you. You'll be fine on less food. V'shavtem lavetach aleha, and you shall dwell in security on the land. V'chi somru, and when you say, manochal mashana ashevius, what will we eat in the seventh year? Hey lo nizrav lano sofes tfuasenu, we're not planting, we're not gathering our produce, what are we going to eat? Says Hashem, v'tzivisi esbirchasi lachem bashana ashishis, I will command my bracha to you in the sixth year. V'asas es hatfuan lishlosh hashanim, we will make enough produce for 3 years. The sixth year, the produce of the sixth year will help for the sixth year, for the seventh year, and for a portion of the eighth year until such time that the new crops that were grown in the eighth year will actually be harvested. It takes time for crops to grow and be harvested. And therefore, there will be enough produce in the sixth year to last the sixth, seventh, and part of the eighth years as well. This is a guarantee in the Torah. This is one of the glaring proofs that the Torah could not have been written by a human being, that it must have been written by Hashem. Because no human being in their right mind would have written this. The Torah is guaranteeing that there will be a bumper crop every sixth year, meaning the sixth year of the Shemitah cycle, every 7 years, but in the sixth year of the Shemitah cycle, there will be a bumper crop. If a human being would have written the Torah, the very first time that the sixth year came about and there was not a bumper crop, that person would have been proved to be a charlatan. But that is not what happened. Every time when the sixth year came around, there was a bumper crop, which was to validate what it says here in the Torah. This is a guarantee by Hashem that there will be a bumper crop in this sixth year to sustain you for the sixth year, seventh year, and part of the eighth year. In the Yovel year, if it was a Yovel year, then you needed enough crops in the 48th year, the sixth year of that cycle, to last the 48th year, the 49th year, the 50th year, and part of the 51st year. And there was a bumper crop every 48th year, even in excess of what the bumper crop was in the 6th, 13th, 20th, 27th years. As the Torah then says, Uzratem es hashna shminis, you will then plant the 8th year, v'achaltem min atvo yashan, and you will eat from the old produce, ad hashana tishiis, until the 9th year, ad bo tevuasa, until the produce then is harvested, tochu yashan, you'll eat the old grain. You'll eat the old grain means you'll eat the 6th year crops until you get into the 9th year when you can properly harvest or bring home the 8th year crops. The land will not be sold, which means, what's a good translation of that word? In perpetuity, okay? That meaning when you sell the land, it's going to go back to the original owner. It's not going to go to the buyer forever. Ki li haaretz, says Hashem, because it's mine. It's not your land. You don't own it. I own it. I'm giving you permission to stay there. But it is not yours. Don't pretend that you can decide the rules. It's mine and I make the rules. Ki geirim b'so shavim atemi madi. You are both sojourners and you are dwellers with me. You're not... it's not yours, it is mine. I give you permission to be there. Uvechol eretz achuzaschem, and in all of your land, the land of your inheritance, ge'ulot titnu la'aretz, you shall give redemption to the land, which means the land is going to go back to its original owner. Okay, we are going to stop here for tonight. We still have many rules of real estate that are going to come up, and they are going to be dependent on the Yovel year.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.